Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and joining me today is Rocky Lotka. Hey, Rocky.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for being on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Rocky is another of the guests that needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce you anyway. CTO of Magenic, world-renowned author, speaker, developer of the CLSA.
CSLA. Yeah, it's a tough one.
framework. And co-chair of the VS Live conference, which is on campus this week.
Yes, indeed.
And all-around great guy and resident of the fine state of Minnesota.
Yes, I am, don't you know?
And we're here today. What we're going to talk about today is to talk about modern app development. You're going to give us kind of your take on that. We'll see some demos. We'll get your take on how developers should approach this. Is that fair?
That sounds great to me.
All right.
Yeah, so I think, when I think about modern app development, one of the terms that I use that may be sensational or whatever is that we're entering a post-mobile world.
Didn't we just declare the mobile first, cloud first world, and now we're in the post-mobile world?
We did. Okay. I mean, we can't stop. We got to rush through these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and the reason I say that is because when people think about mobile apps, for the most part, they don't think about enterprise apps. They're thinking about apps that you can get in a store relatively small apps that, or at least in terms of, they might be a game, it might be a very limited app that provides me the ability to check into my airline, but if I want to do all the real stuff, I have to go to my airline's website.
Right.
Right. And I think that as mobile devices are so rapidly becoming much more powerful, the processors get faster, the memory, all these things, we're rapidly, I think, getting to the point where why do I have to go to the website for my airline? Why can't I just do it all on my phone or my tablet?
So I think increasingly people are understanding. It's the way I think of it. I have one of these. Nokia. Actually, have a 9. Is that a 920?
This is a 1020.
20. Okay, I have a 920, and I call it my phone, but it's a computer.
Oh yeah,
it really is. It runs a version of the Windows operating system, and it has a different form factor, of course. But when I turn it on, I usually don't turn it on to make phone calls. I'm surfing the web.
That's exactly right.
Right. I'm using it as a computer. And when the app, there's an app on it that is the phone app or the text app, occasionally I'll be in the middle of working and then that app will interrupt me because someone's calling or someone's texting. Mm-hmm. So I think of it more that way. I'm not necessarily on my phone. I'm on my phone-sized computer. So in that sense, why doesn't it do more of what a computer does since it already does so much of what a computer does?
And of course, the reason it doesn't is purely software.
Right.
Right? I mean, these devices are easily as powerful as a computer from not that many years ago, right? Maybe even more powerful. And so then you think, well, okay, so it's clearly not that the computer or this device is too slow or even lacks too much memory, because it isn't that long ago that PCs had a lot less memory than phones do.
Yeah, if it's an 8.1, it's got the same core and essentially the same operating system as that.
That's exactly right.
Right?
Yep. And so when I say software, it's our software, right? It's the stuff that we are building or not building for these devices. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so when I think about mobile app development or modern app development, rather, I think it's really the intersection of what we think of as mobile, all these different device forms and so forth, coupled with enterprise development, which a lot of people still do mainframe AS400, but obviously a lot of Windows and Java. There's an assortment, but it's enterprise. It's complex, right?
Right.
A lot of it's back end, but there's always some user interface component. And then the third part that I think about is cloud, whether it's private clouds or public clouds, but. And by cloud, really, I mean ubiquitous access to server resources, whether I'm sitting here or in my office or my home or wherever I might be.
Yes.
And that's why I think it's that's why I use the term post-mobile, is because I don't think mobile has that scope, especially around the inclusion of enterprise-type applications and so forth.
See, one of the reasons I know we've kind of moved beyond it, but I liked the term devices and services, because to me that just said there's data that I want to get to. Typically when I turn on a computer, it's because I want to work with some data. Could be text, could be numbers, but I turn it on to get a job done. That job usually involves, you know, making a call to something somewhere, which is going to send me back some information. I look at it, I maybe manipulate it, and I send it back. Which is essentially what we've, you know, it's forms over data, if you want to think about it that way. We've been doing it for a long time. We'll continue doing it for probably a long time. So in a world where I'm not chained to my desk, if I'm at home on one computer, or I'm sitting here on my phone, or I'm on my tablet or my phablet or whatever device it is, it doesn't really matter. I'm making similar calls to the exact same keeper of the information who sends it back to me, whether it's on the internal network or over the external network, which is basically all the web is, and the fact that it's in the cloud, that's just a server sitting somewhere that has access to whatever I want it to do, and then code runs and I have a UI. So that, to me, was what devices and services were all about. And to me, what modern development, the way I think about it, is extending the ability to get your job done to any number of devices. Whether it's Windows, which of course we hope it is, or something else, which we're okay with too, because the services are running in Azure, and then anybody can talk to that, and you basically now have taken off the shackles, and it's any device talking to services, working with your data, and then you get the job done. Sometimes you have it on a big, powerful machine at your desktop or a laptop. At that point, you would take advantage of more local horsepower and bigger screens. But sometimes you're just on something like this or something like this, where you'd have a different layout and maybe not quite as much local going on. And it's just a question of implementing the app.
That's exactly right. And I think the one big consideration here is to think about the what the user's going to try and accomplish. What is the user's task or their scenario, right? And then which of these types of device are appropriate to accomplish that task. And you know, so it's, I think, pretty unlikely that we're going to find accountants doing their spreadsheets on phones or even tablets, right? I mean, that's
right.
Accountants like to have, well, at least the ones I know, like to have two or three screens, and they like to have high resolution because they get the fonts really small, and they have as much numeric data as they can up on the screen at once. Well, the odds of them abandoning a multi-monitor keyboard mouse-based environment for their primary task seems almost inconceivable.
But they absolutely, when they're at the coffee shop, want to be able to view a report that shows, you know, the trend of accounts payable or, you know, how many people are late or et cetera.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
Yep. And they might even want to be able to view or one of those super detailed spreadsheets, even on a phone, because we're having a conversation, like you say, at the coffee shop, and I might want to say, hey, look at this, but you know, they're going to zoom in on some little teeny piece of the spreadsheet to make it readable on, you know, and that's why I think it's so important that we have Office on these devices, is for that. And I think that's an edge case, though, right? It's not like I'm going to sit for 8 hours doing that. It's literally a brief moment in time where I need to have access to my detailed data. But then you think about checking in for a flight or even booking a flight, to, you know, I could do that on a phone. I should be able to do that on a phone. Now, most of the airlines allow you to check in to flights on your phone.
Checking in is pretty straightforward because there's just a couple questions, right? Are both of you traveling? Read all the list of things you're not allowed to do. How many bags do you have? Pay if necessary. And, you know, that's, and then either print or, more likely if you're on a phone, let us send you your boarding pass.
But I am left wondering why, personally, I have to go use a browser to book a flight. And because that's not that complicated. I mean, from a user experience, certainly their back end is, you know, I'm sure, very complicated. But,
right. The biggest difference is that when you go to look at a flight, I want to fly from here to there on these dates, then the list of choices is potentially this long, right? This many flights to get there, this many flights to come back. So now you got to, not that this is an excuse, but now you got to rethink the UI, right?
Of course. And that's kind of the point, right?
Is the user expected to keep swiping up and up and up? Or, you know, how do I present to the user 27 flight options on a device like that?
Yep. But those, that it's a solvable, we know that's
very
a solvable,
solvable
problem,
yes.
Because there are, in fact, apps that run on tablets and phones that do that, right? And so you're right, it is just a matter of, as developers and user experience designers, being able to rethink and reimagine the way these apps work.
But it's just the UI issue, the logic is exactly the same.
Exactly.
Business that's, logic is 100% the same, right?
And that I think is kind of the key here, and that's why I think we're at the cusp of this, where we're kind of like if for those that can go back as far as when we transitioned to a large part from the mainframe mini computer user experience with green screen terminals into what ultimately was Windows, but it was graphic user interfaces. That transition didn't happen overnight. It happened over a fairly large period of years, and it involved reimagining to some degree, because all of a sudden you've got the mouse and a whole different way that users think about interacting that wasn't possible with the green screen terminals.
So is it safe to say in the mobile development world that we have at this point pretty much picked off the low-hanging fruit, which is consumptive apps, and now we're moving on to the in many ways more interesting stuff, which is more data focused, if you will, or consuming, not just consuming, but
interacting.
Interacting.
With the,
yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
Like that's exactly what's going on, and I also think that our industry, in many different ways, kind of does this pendulum swing. Right.
Always.
So we were all server mainframe based, and then we went all smart client with Windows, and then we realized, oh well, we still need servers.
Yeah.
And then we kind of went back to the web, and everything's essentially mainframe with the browser being a really colorful terminal. And now, it seems like this is smart client development. To build an app for a tablet or a phone, you are building a smart client app.
Right.
And so all the lessons that we learned through the 90s with how to build effective smart client apps on Windows, the actual code might be different, but the concepts are the same, right? And so my hope is that we can take some of those lessons that were learned at that point about how to create really compelling smart client apps that did talk to servers and translate them into how to... Yeah, because again, these devices are easily as powerful as the computers from the 1990s.
Right. Does the programming model and the fact that a phone app or a Windows 8 app is running in the sandbox, does that impact our ability to do that? Do we lose too much stuff moving from the full-featured desktop app to the mobile app?
I do think there are constraints there that have to be considered depending on what you're trying to accomplish. An awful lot of business apps are essentially just forms over data, one way or another. And sandboxes don't really impact those to speak of because the data is stored somewhere on a server in the cloud and the user's interacting with it and it just flows back and forth. But there's no doubt there are applications that need access to specialized peripherals and so forth. And I think we're seeing, the popularity of not only Square, but now PayPal, and I think Amazon is getting into these little card readers that are on all these devices.
Yep.
That's an example of a specialized peripheral, right? And yet... because the market demand is there, the vendors that provide these are making them work on phones and tablets.
Right.
And as an app developer, that's always been kind of the mindset. You know, I'm not likely to write a driver for some specialized peripheral for Windows. I mean, if I'm going to pick the peripheral because it has a driver for Windows.
Right.
Right. And so all these sandboxes have, I don't want to say holes, but engineered mechanisms for people to write the equivalent of a driver so mm-hmm. that I can get at. If I'm the ISV that creates a specialized peripheral, I can make it available to a WinRT developer. I can make it available to an iOS developer.
Right.
Right. So yeah, it's a constraint, but I think that it's a constraint that as we move into this world, the people or companies that make these specialized peripherals are going to solve that for us. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the complaints that I find, or comments maybe, people frequently come up, well, yeah, but I can't get at the whole hard drive. Well, yeah. If you're in an iPad, Apple's trying and has for years now tried to downplay the whole concept of a file system.
Right.
Right. And, you know, on the Android and the Microsoft world, we still have these concepts of file system. But if you look at WinRT and Windows 8, it's been downplayed.
Yep.
Right. There's no file explorer from Microsoft that exists inside of the WinRT world. For what it's worth, I go out and find ones that are third party because mm-hmm. I'm one of these old, like all of us are, people are old style. You know, they think I want to get at my hard drive. Right.
Right?
But your applications are restricted to some degree as to how they can interact with the hard drive. And so people say, oh, that's fraud. You know, I want to be able to write anywhere on the hard drive. Well, okay, so I get that, but the downside is so dramatic, right? The potential for viruses and mm-hmm. malware and so forth. And so personally, as a father in particular, and as to some degree the tech support for my little cul-de-sac, like a lot of us are, mm-hmm. right, all my neighbors, man, the quicker that we can disallow the use of the file system from downloaded apps, the quicker our lives will be better.
Yeah, so if someone says, oh, I want to be able to write to the entire hard drive, I mean, the next question is, why?
That's
and
right.
If you could just write to the local storage, which is your, you know, in your sandbox, mm-hmm. what would you not be able to do? Well, I wouldn't be able to let the user write to anywhere he or she wanted.
But okay. You can, actually, because you've got file open dialogues yeah. and so forth, but you can't do it arbitrarily.
Right.
And I look at this whole thing as being not unlike the uncomfortable switch from Windows XP to Vista or Windows 7, where you know, in XP, all these apps were writing stuff into the program files folders and all sorts of, you know, what ultimately were horrible places,
yeah.
right? And then the rule kind of, you know, the law was laid down and said you can't write to those places anymore. And you have to write to the user's documents folder or, you know, some other clearly specified places.
Right.
And it was a big adjustment. It broke a lot of apps and so forth. But I think we're largely past that at this point, where we're all like, well, of course you wouldn't write into the program files folder. Mm-hmm. And I think this is just an example of the, you know, we just continue to tighten the constraints, I think, just a little bit in order to gain some pretty substantial benefit.
Yeah, one of which is the ability to roam the data.
Well,
so if you have the app installed on three different Windows 8 machines and you write to the local folder, then we can roam that data. And then mm-hmm. when you go home and call up the application and open the document, it's there. Whereas if you write it to just random, or even not random, places on the hard drive, it's not going to get roamed.
That's right.
Right.
And the APIs in WinRT make that roaming concept, you know, super easy.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to see with universal apps where the roaming will, you know, run off to your Windows phone mm-hmm. and your Windows tablet and
yep.
your Windows desktop.
Yep.
Right? It's pretty cool. And I think we're also starting to see an increasing number of apps that step one, maybe beyond that, into the cloud and say, you know, if the app stores its data in OneDrive, for example,
mm-hmm.
Now it roams to an Android device or an iPad.
Correct, yep.
So OneDrive or I'm sorry, OneNote rather, would be a key example there. In my mind, I use OneNote all the time,
yes.
Right? And not in small part because it doesn't matter where, you know, which device I use. And I can even get at it through the web if I, you know, don't have a better experience through a device. I think every app should be that way, including my business. Yeah, I want that. This, I think, is the thing: is I want my corporate apps to have the same kind of, you know, broad experience like
right.
that.
The things that you create are part of the data of the app, and anytime you launch the app, you should be able to get to the data, right?
That's right.
And so to say to a user, the user says, "Well, I opened the app at home and I couldn't get to the data." Right? That's a bad app, right? Mm-hmm. The users are not going to be happy with that. So, yeah, you absolutely want to understand that's a feature of the app, and it's a feature of, you know, being able to write the apps that run on multiple devices.
So, when I think about what's going on now, then I think that you know, another piece of this, of course, is that we clearly are unable to focus just on Windows.
Mm-hmm.
I realize, painful, sorry, but I mean, it's just the reality, and obviously Microsoft recognizes that too with the broad embrace of Angular, HTML5 frameworks, you know, Node.js, Xamarin.
Azure's and essentially agnostic, and Visual Studio has tons of great tools for it, whether it's the Xamarin or the Cordova tooling that came out. Absolutely, we totally recognize and embrace it. We obviously have preferences as to what devices people purchase, but when it comes to building apps, we're pretty agnostic about it, and increasingly agnostic.
And I think that leaves that puts us as developers in an interesting spot because, frankly, we've been spoiled for the last probably 20 years, maybe 15. The vast majority of client devices have been Windows devices,
right?
Well, PCs basically,
yep.
Right? And so, either you built for the web or you built for Windows. And if you're a smart client developer, you built for Windows. I mean, you don't even have to stop and think about it, right?
Yep.
But now we can't. Now it's a real interesting spot. Not unlike, and this is. Goes way back in time, but not unlike the pre-Windows days when did you build for a mainframe, and if so, which kind, or did you build for an HP 3000 or a VAX, or you know, or did you build for DOS, or
right?
You had to make all these choices, and companies almost never wrote for more than one of these platforms because the cost was prohibitive.
Right.
Nothing was in common, no APIs, no tools, nothing. Well, to some degree, we're back at that point where, at least if you just stick with the vendor tools, writing in Xcode for the iPad and writing maybe in Eclipse or something for Android and writing in Visual Studio for Windows, completely disparate.
Yeah.
Right? And so, and yet everybody's got all this BYOD stuff, right? So we're thinking, oh, well, maybe we have to write everything for all three platforms. And maintain it forever, right?
And even if you standardize on a platform, the platform could change, right? Delta, the in-flight purchase app, is now a Windows 8 app. A year ago, I think it was an iOS app.
That's probably true.
Yeah,
yep.
So they essentially changed platform.
Yep.
And it's a lot easier to buy everybody a new phone than it is to, you know, say, oh, all the desktops were going to change, you know, from one operating system to another. That's a gigantic deal.
It is.
To give all the flight attendants a different phone running a different app is not that big a deal in a lot of ways.
Well, and this is part of
and
the
now
fun,
you're the
right?
developer because who a year ago was building this, you know, I'm sure it was a fine app, this, you know, excellent iOS app written natively for the iPhone, and then it turns out that we're going to move over to Windows.
Yep.
So, you know, if you were building with Xamarin, you would have been protected.
well, and here we enter into the what I think is the interesting topic of the day, which is I don't believe it's cost effective in the long run for us to write all these apps and maintain them multiple times in different technologies.
Yeah.
I mean, it just makes no sense. And if all you got to do is sit down with a spreadsheet for just a little short period of time and say, okay, how much would it cost to build and maintain this app three times?
Mm-hmm.
And then how much would it cost to just buy all of my employees a Surface?
Right.
I guarantee you it would be infinitely cheaper to just buy all your employees a Surface or a Windows Phone, mm-hmm. or Android. I don't really care, right? I mean, well, okay, so I kind of care. But the point is, it would be way cheaper to just buy everybody the same device than it would be to try and build and maintain these apps.
There are obviously edge cases when you want to do it the native way. The SkyDrive team at the time, the OneDrive team, decided explicitly that they were going to write the OneDrive app for all three platforms natively because they wanted the 100% best native experience. And they decided, you know, I mean, if you think about it, we're trying to get users of other devices to love our services. So in that case, it's worth the extra money, even if it's a huge amount of extra money, to build first-class, awesome experiences so that people will then be attached and grow to love the services.
I don't dispute that at all.
That's like, why wouldn't you? Well, I have a good reason why I wouldn't. Okay, if you have a good reason why you wouldn't, but your default position, you're right, should not be to do three times the work.
Well, and I think it comes down to your business model, right? So Microsoft's business model with OneDrive, for example, is to try and reach everybody on the planet and have them use your cloud service, right?
Right.
Delta, with their app that their flight attendants are using, their objective is to make their flight attendants more effective in a very cost-effective way. And so multi-platform, this is where that calculus comes in, where it's clearly cheaper to buy everybody the same device.
Yeah.
And so if you're in corporate America or corporate Earth, I guess, however you want to look at it, and you're building an app that's primarily for your employee base, versus your consumer base or customer base.
Right.
Radically different things in terms of how do you make that decision.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do think that, again, we've been spoiled for probably 20 years. It's all been Windows and it's all, right, that's been easy. Now all of a sudden it's very disparate. But what we are seeing is the rise of tools like Xamarin or Cordova and I think there are a variety of others that are trying to make it practical for me to use pretty much all of my code and have it run on iOS, Android, Windows. And it may not be the paramount experience on every device, right? And which is why you still might go native per device, especially if you're trying to reach out to consumers. But if I'm building a corporate app, you just look back over the last, probably many decades, when have decision makers decided that corporate apps should be the pinnacle of user, they're not. They're gray screen, they're clumsy, they're clunky, right? But they work, and they allow the user to get their job
done. But I've heard increasingly that doesn't cut it anymore. That because people have devices like this, on their own, that when they come to work, if you write a mobile app, it's got to be first class and it's got to work and look great. Good enough isn't good enough. I've heard that from a number of people, even for enterprise line of business apps.
And I do think there's truth to that. I think it depends on the individual person in charge of the decision making inside of a company. But to me, there's this analogy with when we went from green screen to GUI, and there's this inversion of user experience that occurred at that time, where I would go home and use things like TurboTax that were almost infinitely easier and more pleasant to use than the software that I had at work.
Right.
And so as a normal person, you stop and you think, okay, so my employer is this big corporation that makes millions or billions of dollars and has budgets that I can't even fathom.
Yeah.
and I come home with my family budget, which clearly has limits I can fathom.
Right.
And yet my computing experience is better at home than it is at work. And so we've got one of those inversions again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so it did. It drove clearly a level of change that was pretty profound. And at the same time, it never drove corporate apps to be at the level, or, well, I shouldn't say never, but rarely, mm-hmm. at the level of a TurboTax or a Quicken or a Microsoft Money back when that existed.
Right.
Oh, that makes me so sad.
I still use it.
But, you know, I mean, because there's always in my mind, or observation, I guess, been this distinction between consumer apps that I have to make good enough that you will give me money for, mm-hmm. versus corporate apps that have to be good enough that they're productive, but you're going to use it because I pay you, right? It's not the same.
Because you have no choice,
yeah, right. So I do think that's true, that the again, the bar is being raised with the assumption that apps, especially if you look at modern Windows apps, mm-hmm. Will have touch support at a peer level with keyboard and mouse. Now, some of these other devices that are touch-only, the keyboard and if there is a mouse experience are probably very secondary,
mm-hmm.
right? Keyboards are optional. They're probably a Bluetooth,
yep.
you know, but certainly on the Windows world, WinRT, that's part of what I love about it, is that it by default, keyboard, mouse, touch, they just all work.
Right, exactly.
Which I find very exciting, frankly. But at the end of the day, I look at Magenic's business, and the vast majority of what we do is build .NET apps, right? And a lot of them are ASP.NET, mm-hmm. Web API, you know, WCF, but a fair amount are still WPF apps. There's quite an investment on the part of smart client development for Windows.
Right.
But one of our more rapidly growing segments in the company, I suppose not surprisingly, is our group that does Android and iOS development.
Mm-hmm.
And because of our Microsoft focus, the majority of those Android and iOS apps are talking to .NET services somewhere.
Right.
But our users, our customers say, well, you know, we need it to run on these multiple devices. And I think increasingly what we're trying to do is push people toward platforms or tools that allow us to get across all these different device types without having to write and maintain everything multiple times.
Right.
But yet it's this interesting, you know, so we'll do proof of concepts with something like a phone gap, and sometimes the users are like, huh, that'll work. And sometimes the users are like, well, that's not really a native app, is it?
Right.
And they'll pay the difference in order to make it, be native. And personally, I hope this is where Xamarin is able to step in, and because it provides a much more performant native level mm-hmm. Implementation, still being able to use all of the skills that I have in
right.
terms of C# and .NET.
So do your customers care whether you write it natively or in something like Xamarin?
They do. Primarily because at this point in the evolution of mobile development, there's a lot of risk in terms of what technology you pick. Hmm. And I believe there really is, right? I mean, we don't know 5 years from now, will Android even still exist? Will iOS still exist? Will Windows still exist? We don't know, right? Not in any definitive sense.
Okay.
And you might say, well, that's, you know, I'm being sensational, but I used to be, and people that have heard me talk will laugh at this, but I used to be a DEC VAX programmer.
Right.
And DEC was the number two computer maker in the world. And within a 5-year period, they went to being a subsidiary of HP. mm-hmm. and nobody's ever heard of him anymore, right? And so 5 years, the number two computer player in the world can essentially disappear.
Sure.
And you know, not that I'm trying to paint a doom or gloom scenario, but the what I'm trying to get at is that if I'm a if I build line of business app and I spend a couple $1 million building it, I expect that it's going to run for 10 or 15 years.
Right.
So what should I use, Robert, that's going to be here in 10 to 15 years, right? I personally have pretty high confidence that Windows will be here in 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I guess what I would want...
But will PhoneGap be here in 10 or 15 years, right? This is the question.
Well, it winds up being... And that way it becomes... If you want to write the app and will it be running in 10 years, that's really a runtime issue, right? You can run FoxPro apps today. You can run VB6 apps today. If you need to make changes to it, I don't know that you can find the environment or people that know how to do it.
Right.
But that's kind of a constant. But the runtime, Windows supports that runtime, and they'll continue to run. You can't install it on an RT device, but... You know, if you made it as part of your system image, then it would certainly run. So from the runtime perspective, I can't speak for other vendors, but pretty much anything you do today, there's an excellent chance, you can rest assured, that there's an excellent chance that it will continue to run for quite some time. Now, there's, you know, always the issue of the development tool, the model that I use, the APIs, where are those going to be in 5 or 10 years? You know, the answer is probably advanced, evolved.
Well, and
right.
But
that's no different than it's always been, is it?
That's true, except that we're in a period of increased turmoil compared to where we've been for the last couple decades, right? And so people are spoiled. Right, I could pick.
So what you're telling me is that the turmoil that 10 years from now, the turmoil that's going to be caused when certain technologies become, what's the proper term? That go into maintenance mode, or we stop evolving them because something else has happened. That the turmoil is going to be greater in 10 years than it has been the past 10 years.
No, I would.
That's a scary concept.
I would hope that we'll settle down again.
Okay, right? Good.
I think that we're, and this term comes up from time to time, but there's this concept of inflection points,
mm-hmm.
right, or huge tectonic shifts, however you want to describe it. Going from the mainframe mini computer world to Windows was one of those.
Yes.
And in the early days of that, there were a bajillion vendors that gave all sorts of tools to write Windows apps,
mm-hmm.
and most of them died, right? Or if they didn't die, they kind of became little niche players that nobody's heard from for a decade,
right?
And so, were you to have written your enterprise app on one of those, at some point you probably had to rewrite your enterprise app onto a more supported tool.
Yes,
and I know this because Magenic and we made a lot of money rewriting FoxPro, mm-hmm. and VB6 and Power Builder and SQL Windows and whatever other apps into
Delphi,
I guess is how they say it in Europe.
Many
of those have been rewritten into .NET, for example,
yeah.
or some of them were rewritten into VB6 and then into .NET And so now we're back in one of those periods of tectonic shift, though, right? In that we're going from a pure keyboard mouse world into a touch world. We're going mm-hmm. into a world where things like battery considerations outweigh a lot of other considerations.
Right.
The way we think about building a lot of the software is fundamentally shifting.
Yep.
Right? And the user experience, as to your earlier point, the bar is being raised. And so which of the myriad tools that are out there to do this should I pick?
Visual Studio.
Well, of course. I'm just saying. I understand why people angst about this and why they don't just give us carte blanche to say, to pick, nor in fact would we as Magenic want carte blanche to pick the tool, because then who gets blamed if we happen to pick the wrong tool? Right, and 3 or 5 years from now, we have to spend another, or the customer has to spend another couple $1 million to rewrite the app into what is then a viable technology.
I see.
Right? So it's, and the, so I agree. I think Visual Studio, I think probably Xamarin are pretty safe bets at this point. Mm-hmm. But clearly, if you, the other safe bet, excuse me, the other safe bet is almost certainly just to go native per platform. Unless you think one of these platforms is going to completely fall by the wayside. And I don't discount that. That was kind of my point.
Okay. Is
I think that's not an unrealistic thing to think might happen. But, like, it's on the lower... That's less probable than, you know, Joe's fly-by-night super cross-platform dev tool.
Right.
That's probably not going to survive.
Okay. That's a fair point. So as long as people pick Visual Studio, they're probably safe and we're happy.
No bias here at all, right?
No, absolutely not. It's a totally factual statement.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm biased too, so I would prefer if people chose Visual Studio and Xamarin over a lot of the other options. But
cool. Do you want to show some Visual Studio?
I'd love to.
All right. Let's flip over to there.
I think that Visual Studio recently, and by recently I mean really recently, in the updates to Visual Studio 2013, has come out with some really compelling tooling to help mitigate some of this cross-platform churn, if you will. And this is part of why I think I've gotten so excited recently about using Visual Studio combined with Xamarin to do a lot of this cross-platform work, that it's not only Xamarin trying to do this, but it's Microsoft building things into the tool that also enables it. So
right.
That gives a lot of credence to this overall strategy. One of them is that Microsoft introduced this universal app concept.
Yep.
But underneath universal apps is an even more powerful technology called shared code projects or shared projects.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we start just at a high level and say that I would like to create a universal app, I've got this ability to create an app that's going to run on Windows 8 WinRT and also Windows Phone WinRT.
Right.
And so if I create one of these, Visual Studio is going to create not just a project, but a solution that contains multiple projects.
Yep.
And looking at these projects, maybe I can even zoom in so that we can see them more clearly.
There we go.
We end up with the Windows 8 project, the Windows Phone project, both of which are UI projects. They're going to generate essentially an EXE,
right,
or
you
know,
in the future,
you
can expect additional types of projects to appear there.
I would certainly think so.
Not announcing anything, but you can expect.
Are you sure you don't want to announce anything right now?
I'm announcing that you can expect in the future to maybe see additional things.
Ah.
I don't think I've broken any new ground.
All right.
I'm pretty sure we already said that.
I believe I've heard that, yes. and then the interesting part here is that there's also this shared project.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that, and what happens here is that the shared project is never directly compiled. It's compiled as part of the Windows
right.
Phone project, and it's compiled as part of the Windows 8
Which
project.
Which takes a tiny bit of getting used to because you can't add references to it, you can't add NuGet packages to it, right?
No. In fact, if you if I zoom out here and we look at the properties for this project, unlike a normal project, the properties here are pretty limited.
Yeah.
The big one, and you will want to change this if you're doing this by hand or creating, is you probably want to change the root namespace so that as you add new classes and types into the shared project, the default namespace ends up however you're doing it in terms of your organizational structure. But otherwise...
Wait, what?
What? Say that again? Well, I usually try to have my namespaces organized. So this is Hub App 1, because that's the name of the overall app, right? Which is not a bad default, but okay. I'll often put my corporate name dot something.
Oh, okay, I see.
Right?
I thought you were saying that code that goes in the shared would be in its own namespace.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. I'm saying that you have to think... So it's good to clarify that. Just as a general rule, when I start creating even class libraries, I tend to go in and change the top-level namespace property to conform to my company's standard around namespace naming.
Right.
And the same thing would be true here.
Okay.
And yeah, so it does take a little getting used to, but if you have used linked files before, which is a concept that's been in Visual Studio maybe since day one, mm-hmm. and certainly is something that people that did a lot of Silverlight and server development got very used to, because the best way to share code between .NET and Silverlight was to link files, and then later, maybe in 2012 or early 2013 Visual Studio, you could go in and manually edit the project file to link folders, which was, okay, that was really nice, but I had to manually edit the project file. This basically does that.
Right.
Right, this is just built-in tooling to make that possible.
Yep, so anything that's in the shared project, in air quotes, is compiled into both the Windows and Windows Phone project.
Yeah, or compiled as part of. Yep.
Right.
Might be the better way to put that. And so if I, for example, add a class to this, if we add a new item and just add a simple class to this shared project, now we can see that it added the class here.
Mm-hmm.
When I compile the solution, my Windows Phone project and my Windows 8 project will both, as part of their compilation, compile this class.
Right.
And so the class is literally part of the Windows 8 app, and it's literally part of the Windows Phone app.
Yes.
And so it gives me the ability to write this one bit of code and maintain it, keep it in source control exactly one time, but it's included in multiple projects.
Yes. You can do code there. You can do UI there.
Mm-hmm. As long as you're... You can do anything there that will compile in both project types.
And for the UI, it means that your UI is going to, for the most part, look the same across the two. You can in the code, add and remove pieces. You can, using the compiler directives, if Windows app, if Windows phone app.
Well, and that's right. So most of your code, one would hope, is going to be just normal .NET code or XAML that is consistent between both the phone and Windows 8.
I was writing a sample app, and I wanted to include an example of using this directive. And I kept looking for things like talking to the file system, like talking to the camera, and I couldn't find one other than talking to the file system. I wanted to, something different, and I spent like a couple days on it, and I couldn't find a good example of something that wasn't just in both APIs, so I gave up.
Well,
there are things in there, but the point is that most of the code you write is able to be shared.
Yes, right.
You're going to wind up actually not using these as much as you think you might.
That's correct. And that's,
which
that's
is
been,
good. That's a great thing.
That's
we talked
my experience.
About the convergence of the API, and it turns out we delivered on it.
Delivered pretty
to
well.
To more of an extent than you might think, actually.
Yeah, it's well, for example, this is the technique that I use to make CSLA run across all these different platforms. Mm-hmm. And CSLA, as you might guess, is at the framework level in its code, does some pretty sophisticated stuff that is often very platform specific, and so even between the client you know, for example, .NET server code, we use certain features of threading that don't exist necessarily in the phone to optimize for server-side code.
Right.
And we use this technique with the poundIF to do that. But there's very few differences between, for example, WinRT on the phone and WinRT on Windows 8, which is a testament to how much this convergence has come along, right?
Yeah.
Now, if we go just a little bit further with this, what gets really fun, I think, so this gets me to Windows 8, gets me to Windows Phone, but there's an add-in for Visual Studio called the Shared Project Reference Manager. It's in the gallery, so you can just go under tools and let's see if we go online here and look for the shared project. So the shared project reference manager.
Yeah.
And if you add this into Visual Studio, it's a V6, so it just installs itself. Then what this allows me to do is to say, okay, in my solution, I would like to, add myself a new project. And now in my project list, I've got some shared templates that were added by this V6. Mm-hmm. So I can say, okay, I'd like to add a shared C# project. And maybe this is where I'm going to put my shared business code. Right. And I want to be kind of clear about this, because this Hub App 1 shared, as you can see, includes XAML and other UI concepts.
Right.
So it's that shared project is, as part of the template, designed to include UI code for both Windows 8 and Windows Phone. So suppose that I want to have some shared business code that I might share not only between the phone and Windows 8, but maybe WPF or Android.
Okay.
So I'm going to add my own shared business code project. And then the other piece of this add-in is that I can go up to my Windows Phone and I can say that I would like to add a shared project reference. And when I pick that, now it gives me a list of all my shared projects, and I can add my business code. And I can go here and do the same thing for Windows 8.
So you're not just limited to the shared project that Visual Studio creates for you.
That's correct.
Cool.
So now I've got two shared projects. And now here I can, for example, add another class. Maybe we'll actually give this one a name so it's not so confusing. We'll call this one Customer or something. And so now I've got this customer class that's going to compile into both of those UI projects.
Right.
But what I can do now, and this is where I think it gets a lot more fun in some ways, is now I can say, okay, let's go add a new project and let's add a WPF application into my solution. Because maybe some of my users are still on Windows 7.
Right.
I say maybe.
Yeah.
maybe 99% of them are still on Windows 7. And I can say, okay, I would like to add a shared reference and bring in that shared business code. And so now I'm able to use that same exact business code that's maybe calling my web API or whatever it's doing, right? And I can use it on WPF, WinRT for Windows 8, and WinRT for Windows Phone.
So this begs a couple questions. I know if you used a portable class library, you have to decide up front what platforms you're supporting so the compiler knows.
That's right.
And this shared project, how is it keeping track of where you're calling it from?
It's not. This is the kind of the compare and contrast. So the portable class library, you have to decide up front, and the only code that you can write is the lowest common denominator code. Which is fine. I mean, that's not a bad thing, but it certainly is a substantial constraint. Here, I write this code, and if I go to build, because it's going to build it into each of the three different platforms, it'll either build or it won't.
Okay,
And if the code doesn't build, then I know that I need to go back in here, and it probably won't build for only one of the platforms. Right. And so then I say, okay, well,
because you're calling something in the WinRT from a WPF.
Yep, yep. I might use some piece of reflection that works in .NET that doesn't work
in... Or you could stick ADO.NET in here, system.data, and it'll build for the WPF, but not the other ones.
So that's where you put, you know, some sort of, you know, if, you know, full.NET, you know, do something different than if I'm on the other platforms.
Right. Okay.
And again, that's relatively rare, but there are, like you said, if you interact with ADO.NET, that would be one. Reflection is different between WinRT and the rest of .NET. So there are cases where you end up running into that, and then you just have to do this. But the majority of your code will be the same code. And I find this personally more compelling than the portable class library, because I'm able to look at one screen and see all my code, and if there are minor variations for different platforms, I can see it right there.
The portable class library won't let you include code that isn't in the specified platforms.
Right.
This lets you include everything, and then it's up to you to use the compiler directives to make sure it builds.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So, I'm not saying one's better than the other, but
they're different.
They're different, and you have to think about which one's going to get you where you want to go.
Right.
Right. Now, if we take one more step, just to make this even more fun, is, so I've got Xamarin tools installed on my machine here, and there's a couple ways that I can approach Xamarin. I can create an Android app, I can create an iOS app, and both of these are perfectly valid. Xamarin recently added this concept of mobile apps with Xamarin Forms, which is very similar in concept to what Microsoft has done with Universal Apps. And so here, if I say that I'd like to create a blank Xamarin Forms app, I get to choose whether it uses the portable class library technique that we were talking about. Or in this case, because I'm already down the shared project road, I'm going to say that I'd like to do a shared project portable app. And so I cannot add... Oh, yeah, I got to add it at the solution level. Let's try this again. And actually, let's call this... given a name. And so, similar to the Microsoft Universal App template, this doesn't create just a project. It creates, if I use it from scratch, it'll create a solution. In this case, it's going to add to my solution a set of projects.
Yep.
I don't have a Mac hooked up right at the moment, so it won't be able to connect to the iOS build host. That's one of the constraints when working in iOS, is that the compiler has to run on a Mac, right? But it'll still create the project for me, so we're okay. And so now if I look at the solution, and we kind of zoom in here so we can see it a little closer, I have all the things I had before, plus now I have a shared hub mobile project and a hub Android and hub iOS. This is exactly like the universal project for that we were doing before. So this iOS project is the UI project for the iPad or iPhone. This Android project is the shared project or the UI project for Android. The hub mobile project is a shared project that can contain common UI code.
Right.
And because Xamarin Forms has a XAML language or a set of XAML controls that are common across Android and iOS, you can use that XAML in this project to create a common UI.
And Windows Phone Silverlight.
And Windows Phone Silverlight, which it did add in here.
Right.
Unfortunately, at the moment, at least, they don't support Windows Phone 8.1, you know, WinRT.
At the moment.
But I wouldn't be surprised, I guess, to see them expand that.
Yes.
So this is all good, but now, of course, I can go in and I can say, okay, I'd like to add a shared project reference.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to add my shared business code.
Yes.
To the Android app.
And then you would...
And I can do the same to iOS.
And if necessary, you would define additional compiler directives if iOS app, if Android app, if necessary.
That's exactly right. So if we go look at the build, I can add in a, Android conditional, and I can say pound if Android.
Wow. That is cool.
That is extremely cool. And so now I've got this way of creating a common set of shared code that's in source control once that compiles natively into Android, iOS, Windows Phone, Silverlight, Windows Phone, WinRT, WinRT, and WPF or ASP.NET or what have you. Extremely compelling.
Yeah, so that gives you, again, the ability to add additional types of devices. Could be... You've got a WPF app there. It could be a WinForm app, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's exactly right.
Presumably. So it's not just... We talk quite a bit about Windows 8, Windows Phone, iOS, Android, but it's not just those.
No. I think WPF and Windows Forms, for a lot of people, Windows Forms may be the biggest thing going, right?
Yeah, and there's no reason that you've got a WinForms app talking to a WCF service, talking to SQL Server internally, and you say, we want people to be able to get to this information not just when they're at work, behind the firewall. So you move the data and the services into the cloud, and then you just have the WinForm app point to that, and then you build all the other device apps that point to that, and bingo. Modern app. It's that simple. Bingo.
Yeah, just like that. No effort at all.
It's actually not that hard to move the data into Azure, move the service into Azure, and then point the WinForm or WPF app to talk to the service.
If you're already...
That part actually is pretty simple.
If you already have a service-based model, yes, that's right.
The biggest question in that case you got to ask yourself is, if you got a WCF service, you put it in Azure... And if you presumably want authorization and authentication and that kind of stuff, and you're calling it from other clients, should you be actually talking to a web API instead of WCF? That is kind of a potential issue.
Well, here's where there are platform differences that you have to take into account. For example, the Windows Phone WinRT does not yet have a WCF client.
Right.
So they're... If your services are WCF services, you either have to use Windows Phone Silverlight or switch all of your services to web APIs can use HTTP clients.
Or just put up a web API front end of the WCF service, right?
Yep, right?
Instead of rewriting it.
And but this really comes down to, excuse me, when you start looking at the different frameworks that you might use in your applications, picking them based on the breadth of platforms they support. So in your client application, you should, for example, avoid using system.data because it doesn't exist everywhere.
Yes.
And there's a whole set of different things that you should, you should avoid using web request versus HTTP client.
Yep.
HTTP client is available in one form or another everywhere, and this is where you end up with at least some pound if statements to get to Android and iOS, because it's not quite the same, but it's so close that at least your amount of work is reasonable to get across all platforms, whereas something like older, like web request, would not be consistent that way.
Right.
Where using JSON serializing, you might use the JSON.net from Newtonsoft, because that's consistent across all the platforms, whereas some of the other, or even the built-in Microsoft or JSON serializers, are not consistent.
Right.
And so I'll plug my framework, CSLA, in that it, too, we've put a lot of work into making sure it's consistent across all these platforms. And so, in fact, in this example that we're looking at right here, I could make that common business code, use CSLA, and get all the business rule engine and all the other things that CSLA brings to the table. And it would compile across all these platforms because we've made sure that CSLA works consistently across them all.
Cool.
so that you don't have to worry about pound-iffing everything all over the place, right?
Right. Excellent. Cool. Any last thoughts before we let the viewers get on with their lives? Been here for an hour.
Been here
it's
for an hour.
It's an excellent hour, but we should probably wrap it up.
I think we should. Yep. So, no, other than that, I think, you know, the last two or three years have been extremely turbulent.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of this inflection point, and I'm hopeful that we're coming out the other side where we're starting to see where there's some of the tools are maturing around Cordova, around Xamarin,
right.
And so it's becoming less murky as to which tools you would pick, especially if you've got an investment in Microsoft as a platform already.
Yep.
I think that the it's becoming clear that you know, Windows is a great thing to bet on. Visual Studio is really a great thing to bet on. And yeah, if you've got Android and iOS and you need to support those, then Xamarin or Cordova, you know, the tooling is rapidly coming into place, and I'm quite excited.
Yeah, excellent. All right, thanks for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having
excellent
me.
Excellent conversation. Hope you enjoyed that, and we will see you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.